Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on modern science and Noah's Ark when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell was one of the pillars of modern geology, and Lyell published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe in Lyell's concepts don't even know who it was that originated these ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised by simply projecting all of the natural processes that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood have been strictly ruled out. And this process is falsely called science. Well, listen to this. When we talk about erosion, what's even more surprising is the discovery that all of the continents on Earth would be worn down to sea level in just 14 million years at today's rate of erosion. But there is no evidence for such drastic erosion, and the mountains and valleys on Earth appear to have been very recently made. Their sharp, angular appearance testifies to their youthfulness, not to their age. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the extinction of the dinosaurs? Can you remember that story? That was 65 million years ago. But 14 million years ago, just using the process that we're observing today of erosion would have made the Earth as smooth as a billiard ball. And that's not what we see today. Now, is it? Now, we don't have to be rocket scientists to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda that masquerades under the banner of science. And this is one more of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here in Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now and ask for one. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about modern science and Noah's Ark. Last time we were talking about the need for an ark, number five. These are seven evidences. We haven't arrived at proof yet. You know, we're just talking about evidence so far. Seven evidences here that would tend to prove the worldwide nature of the flood, or the basic arguments for a universal flood. Now, there are three schools of thought here. Let's review those quickly as we begin today's program. One school of thought, the evolutionary or scientific school of thought, they like to call themselves scientific, is that no flood ever occurred, period, and that's the end of that report. And the second school is the fundamentalist view. Yes, there was a flood and it was worldwide. And then in between is this kind of let's sit on the fence and put both ears to the ground at the same time. They believe there was a flood, but the flood wasn't worldwide, that it was local, such as the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And then we built this big ark in the valley here to save all the animals and all of, well, a few of the men, just eight. And we're going to wipe out all of the men on planet Earth, all the people on planet Earth. Oh, wait a minute. No, we couldn't wipe out all the people on planet Earth because the people that are outside of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley wouldn't be affected, would they? So I guess then that all the people that lived on planet Earth were all living in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, that they had not migrated outside of the valley. Got that? All of mankind is living in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley over in a place that we call Iraq today. They had not migrated out of the valley yet. In 1,656 years, they have not figured out how to get beyond the banks of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. Huh? Can you see why it is that evolutionists deride religious people? Now, the general belief is, this is where evolutionists and scientists come in, they believe that this is biblical teaching, this local flood theory, that this religious ideology comes from the Bible. Nothing could be further from the truth. Religious people do not believe the Bible. They claim to believe some portions of the Bible, but most of it they don't have any more use for than does the evolutionary or scientific community. So what we have here is the evolutionist. He says, well, I reject the biblical account because it's religious, and the religious people reject it because it's not scientific. And outside of both of these views, there is the truth of the matter, but we haven't arrived at where that's located yet. So in case you thought religious people over here packing Bibles into their arms like Bill Clinton, when he's coming out of church, Bill has a Bible under his arm. But does he read it, and does he believe it, and does he follow and practice it? See, the answer to all of the above is no, not at all. And neither do any of the other Christians out there. I know somebody's going to write me a letter now and say, well, this Christian does. Well, you know, maybe you're an exception to the rule, Mr. Christian, that obeys God, keeps his commandments, and believes the scripture. But the general rule of Christianity certainly isn't that. As is evidenced by what we're discussing here in modern science and Noah's Ark and this concept of the local flood. All right, now going on, the writers have had a difficult time. These are the writers of the local flood theory. Have had a difficult time, these local flood advocates, to find someone that's willing to face the implications of this argument called the need for the ark. But one, Arthur Custance, however, has recently suggested that the ark was simply an object lesson to the antediluvian people. It's just an object lesson. All right, now here's what Custance says. Here's a local flood guy. He says, it would require real energy and faith to follow Noah's example and build other arks, but it would have required neither of those to pack up a few things and migrate. And I'm going to pause right there and point out. Evidently, Arthur Custance believes that all of mankind is locked into the valley. Because when this flood comes, it's going to wipe out all of the people except for Noah and his family inside the ark, which is the purpose now. It's an object lesson, and this is why we're building the ark. Now listen to his words. He says, but it would have required neither of these to pick up a few things and migrate. So if there was a flood coming, he says, it wouldn't take anything but to just pick up a few things and leave. That's exactly correct. During the Mississippi flood over here in 1993, when the waters came up, guess what the people did? They picked up a few things and they left. They didn't need an ark, which is the point of this argument. If you need an ark that weighs 14,000 tons, you need something more than is going to occur here in the local valley, don't you? Come on, Mr. Custance. Come on, all you people out there. Let's wake up and smell the coffee. So the general consensus of opinion is that mankind is very dumb. Very dumb. Kind of like a brute beast like Neanderthal, see? But slowly but surely, over a long period of time, he's getting smarter and smarter. And so we point back and we say, look at this. 200 years ago, we couldn't fly airplanes, but now we can fly airplanes, which proves we're getting smarter and smarter. They've got a good point there. It does prove that man has been pretty dumb for a long time, and he is getting smarter and smarter. But does that mean that the antediluvians were dumb Neanderthals? See, that's another part of the story that you've been told. It's like, I believe that man is getting smarter and smarter because that's what I'm observing over the last 200 years. And I have observed all of my life that the ark is too small for all those animals because that's what I saw in my coloring book. That's what I've always seen depicted. And so we come to a conclusion early on in life, and we come up with these beliefs. Now, let me tell you a little story here. I did a series of programs here on a book one time called Dead Men Tell Tales. Dead Men Tell Tales. Now, in 1945, we real smart human beings here, see, we're smart. We developed nuclear energy, and we set off an atomic bomb. Remember that story? J. Robert Oppenheimer and gang, you know, they set off a bomb down in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Underneath the tower, after they got through, they went back, you know, and they took a look at what had happened there, and they saw this green glass under the tower. And it's called atomic glass because this bomb is really hot. And it melts the sand. Unlike volcanoes, which create molten rock, molten rock called lava, these atomic bombs create a thing called atomic glass. It's a phenomenon that only occurs with the explosion of a nuclear weapon. Did you know that? See, we didn't know about that until 1945. Now, did you know that prior to 1945, archaeologists have found 27 locations around the world? Write that number down here, boys and girls. 27 locations around the world where we find this atomic glass. Did you know that? It's not a natural phenomenon. It isn't something that you find at volcanoes. It isn't something that you find when you melt sand and turn it into glass. It's something that you find when you detonate a nuclear weapon. 27 of those. All of them discovered before 1945. Now, what's that tell you? Prior to 1945, mankind at some point in time was dealing with and exploding nuclear bombs. Well, if you've got some other conclusion or some other theory, write me, would you? Now, here's my point. It hasn't occurred to us yet, but I want to throw this out here, that at one time, mankind was real smart, starting with Adam and Eve and terminating with Noah's flood. And during that period of time, he had a technology, he had an ability that was greater than we have today. Greater than today. How do I know that? Well, let me give you one more quick example from Dead Men Tell Tales. There are a number of monuments around the world made out of great big rocks, like the Great Pyramid. It's made out of 2.3 million great big rocks that weigh 2.5 tons each. And they're all cut rock, and they're all cut square or rectangular, and then they're fit together. All right? Now, this thing of cutting rock is not new. It's been around for a long time. And we have stone buildings today. And we have quarries today. And we quarry rock and we make tombstones. And we quarry rock and we build buildings. I mean, it's been around for a long time. But here's something that hasn't been around for a long time. Down in Peru or Ecuador, I forget which, maybe it's Bolivia, up in the mountains, there's a wall. And this wall has some rocks in it. Not just 2 or 3 tons. One of them's 50 tons. 2 or 3 of them are 30 tons. Many of them are 20 tons. And these rocks are not square. They're random dimensions and configurations. They have rounded corners. Some of them are square. Some of them have rounded sides to them. And they're irregularly shaped blocks of rock. I use the word block. It's actually not true. They're irregular rocks, like boulders. And they are fitted together. So a round concave surface fits into a rounded convex surface to plus or minus, you know, a few thousandths of an inch. There's no technology available to mankind on planet Earth today to do that. And that's just one of many of these sites that we see around the world. Like up there in the, I think it's in Bolivia now, it could be Ecuador. They've got these monkeys and spiders that you can only see from altitude. 6-8 miles. Nobody can build anything like that today. Well, we're not. Now, how do you build a monkey out of rock, 3 feet high, stretching out for 6 miles? Absolutely symmetrical. Who was the engineer that drew that out? Huh? Now, it is true, you know, we did build some canals, you know, like the Panama Canal and like the Suez Canal. We got some big, wondrous projects and works. But you know, sometime in the past, there were some men that had devices that they could measure with and that they could do vast engineering projects and do things that we haven't been able to duplicate today. To give you one more quick example, in 1964, the laser transit was developed. It was in 1964 that they used a laser transit, applied it to the Great Pyramid in Egypt. And they discovered that it was plus or minus 1/2 inch square on all four corners. Plus or minus 1/2 inch. The thing sits on 14 acres. You couldn't measure its accurateness until 1964 with a laser transit. But when I went to school, they taught us that when they built the Great Pyramid, they built it by sewing goat guts together and made a water level. Children, wake up here. I'm an old-timey general contractor. I live in a house that's built 40 by 50 feet. It is 2 inches out of square. This house, 2,000 square feet, built plus or minus 2 inches is perfectly acceptable to anybody. I want to point out that when you can build a block building on 14 acres, and you can do it to plus or minus 1/2 inch. It wasn't built by somebody using a water level sewed together with goat guts. And if you believe that, then you'd have to you'd have to believe in religion to do something like that. You know, there's reason, there's logic, and then there's common sense. Now, by giving you these illustrations here, I'm pointing out that there was a time in the past, when at least some men were smarter than most men today. I don't know how many of those guys there were, but There was enough of them to build the Great Pyramid. There was enough of them to blow up 27 atomic weapons. There was enough of them that they could take blocks of rock, 30, 20, 30, 50 tons, irregularly shaped, and carve them out and fit them together. And the wall is down there to this day. You can take pictures of it. You can go visit it. You can touch it. You can climb up on top of it. You can't do that today. So we're not as smart as those guys were. All right. Now, the point is that when Noah went to build this boat over here, this guy was no dummy. And then this Arthur Custance over here, in his observations that all of the men on planet Earth were locked up in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley for 1,656 years, defies description. It defies mathematics. Because, you see, every 27 years, two people are going to double in their population. And then those people, those four people, are going to double in their population every 27 years. Do you know what that means in 1,656 years? That's 60 doublings. That means there are billions of people on planet Earth. Billions, just like there are today. And when we go around the world today, all of you evolutionists, and all you paleontologists, and all of you scientists and archaeologists, when you go around the world today, you find fossil men. You find fossil human skeletons everywhere around the world. Has it ever occurred to you that you're digging up the remains of these fossilized remains of human beings that were killed in Noah's flood? Has that ever crossed your mind? Have you ever theorized or ever let it enter your mind? I wonder. When I find a fossil man, when I find fossil bones, those bones had to have been buried suddenly and fossilized, or we wouldn't have them today. Let me give you a quick illustration of that. Do you remember the Titanic? The Titanic sank. Remember that? Now, the bodies that did not sink to the bottom of the ocean because they were inside the hull of the ship floated on the surface. And so the next day and for the next week or 10 days, they went out and they picked up all the bodies that they could find floating on the surface of the ocean. And as I recall, they picked up about 1,000 of them. Then they loaded them on ships and they hauled them to Newfoundland. And then they buried them. There's a cemetery up there in Newfoundland. I believe it was Newfoundland or New Brunswick. Newfoundland, I think it was. Or Nova Scotia. It's around Halifax, Nova Scotia. Maybe that's where it's at. Anyway, there's a cemetery there. Then it was dedicated, and it was a memorial, and they buried all of those people. You know, they put them in coffins, and they buried them in the ground. And okay. Well, after about, 75, 80 years, there was a reason to dig up one of those graves. Just one grave. I just wanted to dig up one. It was a little child about, 2 or 3 years old that had died on the Titanic, and they were trying to identify through DNA his parents. They're trying to, the family, for some reason, wanted to do this. And so they dug up the grave, and do you know what they found? They found just 3 little bones left. After 75 years, they didn't even have enough left to take a DNA sample. Now, that's from burial. When an animal dies and you leave it on top of the ground, boys and girls, there's nothing left. It disappears. I've got cows out here, that die in the field, and I just leave them there. And you know what happens after about 5 or 10 years? Well, first of all, the buzzards come and they eat it, and the coyotes eat the carcass, and then they break up the bones, and then pretty soon the littler animals come and they eat the bones. Literally, they eat the bones. There's calcium in them, there's nutritional value, and the rats come and the mice and voles. And after about 5 or 10 years, there's nothing left. It's gone. Just disappears. To have fossils, they have to be buried and fossilized. They have to be kept in an oxygen-free environment. so that they can fossilize in the rock. Otherwise, you don't get fossils. Now, we got fossils everywhere, and fossilized men are on every continent. They're everywhere all around the world, as are fossilized animals, for that matter, fossilized dinosaurs. Has it ever entered anybody's mind that there were dinosaurs on Earth at the Garden of Eden, and dinosaurs at Noah's flood, and dinosaurs after Noah's flood, and that that's the evidence that we're looking at? Because that isn't what we're being told when we go to college. You see, we're being told now that man's really dumb, and that he couldn't get from Asia to North America without a land bridge. You know that land bridge that goes from across the Bering Sea? Now, I want to point out to you boys and girls that today it's about 40 miles across there. You can't, it's farther than you can see. So an Eskimo that's standing over here in Alaska, he cannot see across the water to the other side. Now, I don't think anybody has ever accused the Eskimos of Siberia and the Eskimos of Alaska of being some kind of technological super race now, have they? All right, now listen to this. Do you know that today, in the 21st century, Eskimos from Alaska get into their boats and row across that 40 miles to Siberia, and that Eskimos in Siberia row across that 40 miles to Alaska today in the 21st century? Do you know that? But we're being told here when we go to college that mankind got to North America from this land bridge because without that land bridge, he couldn't get over here because he was too dumb. He just couldn't figure it out. I don't know, kids. I don't know if those thousands of dollars you're spending on college is really worth it. You know that? Because you get letters after your names, and then when you come out, you're stupid. Can't think anymore. Your brains don't function. You can't even recognize what's in front of your eyeballs when you see it, for crying out loud. How in the hell are you going to figure out something that's abstract, that you have to put pieces of the puzzle together to come to a conclusion, like putting evidence together to come to a conclusion? Well, mull it over. Now, this proof number 5 over here, or this misstatement on my part. I haven't arrived at proof yet. This piece of evidence here, the need for an ark, is a very powerful piece of evidence. Because this guy, Custance, over here says, gee, they could just pack up and leave the valley. That's the whole point. Of course they could just pack up and leave the valley. They had absolutely no need for a 14,000-ton ark, unless this flood was going to be worldwide. Now, everybody, well, I wouldn't say everybody, but most people must have known that there was a flood coming because that was Noah's mission. He was building a flood, and he was a preacher of righteousness, and he went out and said, there's a flood coming, there's a flood coming, build an ark, like I'm doing. How many other people build an ark? How many other people survived the flood? Obviously, nobody believed him. And it makes all the sense in the world. Why in the hell would anybody believe that a flood was coming when no flood had ever occurred before? These people have been living here for 1,600 years, and there's never been a flood. There isn't even rain. There's a gentle mist that goes up from the earth, whatever the hell that is. I don't know. You ever seen a gentle mist go up from the earth? Is that evaporation? Is that fog? And it watered the whole face of the earth. I don't know. There was some kind of a different meteorology than there is today. Nobody had ever seen rain. Nobody had ever seen a flood. And here's this guy running around building a 14,000-ton ship. And we've never even had a flood. This guy's telling us it's going to be a flood of water. It's going to kill you. You know, it makes all the sense in the world that nobody would build an ark. Just like today, you know, you take a look at what's going on today. Now, I've made a couple of predictions, not because I'm a prophet or because I'm so damn smart. I said, famine is coming to the United States of America. Get ready for it. How can I figure that out? I'm figuring it out by public policy. I'm looking at the public policy of the Obama administration. I'm looking at the public policy of the United States government from 1950 to 2000, and I say, famine is inevitable. It's coming. Has it happened yet? No. When is it going to happen? I don't know. Just as soon as the conditions are right, it's going to happen. And you're sitting there saying, well, it's going to happen in a million years. Well, I think it'll be a little less than a million years. I don't think that we can continue these kinds of policies. Like, for instance, the policy of importation. The nation's bankrupt. We're importing 50% of our food from overseas. One of these days, the people that are supplying that food and not getting paid for it are going to wake up to the fact that they're getting stiffed and they're going to quit sending the food. And the average Joe Sixpack says, we'll just go grow our own. Good luck. Good luck there, Bob. You're going to grow what there in your condominium in Manhattan? How much are you going to grow there, Bob? Huh? Then I look at our transportation system. You know, I might get to sit here and preach a sermon, you know, about famine in America. Moral of the story is Noah got word that a flood was coming, and so he took his job seriously. He went out and built an ark. And he said, hey, there's a flood coming, get ready for it. Nobody believed him. He got into the ark, and it started to rain. Nobody had ever seen that before. I imagine there was a lot of panic on Main Street when it started raining. I wonder if that guy Noah could be right. All right, now listen, I got to give you a reminder here at the halfway point. What we're trying to do here is figure out whether or not we evolved or were created. Hang on. You're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile. They can be political. Sometimes they're religious or economic or sectarian. They're racial or they're ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. But these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views or the beliefs or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. 49-67. All right, we're talking about modern science and Noah's Ark, and why do we have these beliefs and opinions that we have, and are they really based on any real fact? And so we're trying to apply the six rules of oral, that is, parole testimony, that we would use in court. And we took that from the book, The Testimony of the Evangelist, by Simon Greenleaf, applying these rules of evidence. What evidence would I need if I went into federal district court today to make this presentation? So I took Greenleaf's book. Greenleaf, now remember, was born in Newburyport, Massachusetts. And he began the practice of law in Portland, Maine. He served as professor of law at Harvard University from 1833 to 48. He was instrumental in organizing that university's law program. His three-volume work, A Treatise on the Law of Evidence, is considered a classic of American jurisprudence, and it forms the basis for his study of the Gospels. I applied his principles to these three chapters, chapters 6, 7, and 8 of Genesis, applying to the flood. All right. Now, how can we read the flood account in Genesis 6 through 9 with close attention and then arrive at the conclusion that the ark was built merely to warn the ungodly and not mainly to save the occupants of the ark from death by drowning? And how can we exonerate God himself from the charge of deception if we say that he led Noah to believe that the flood would be universal in order to encourage Noah to work on the ark for 120 years, when he knew all the time that it would not be universal and that it was only going to be local? Now, we need some testimony here. Remember the Kwok Ting test? In order for us to arrive at a conclusion based upon the evidence that we're now considering, this testimony must be complete. Now, this is the story, the testimony in Genesis 6, 7, and 8 is complete. It meets that first test. Now, it is true that it doesn't answer every question that might come to your mind. I don't deny that. But that the story, that is, the narrative, is complete and tells us a complete story is without a doubt true. It tells the story. For instance, it says that every high hill and every mountain was covered by the flood waters. Now, somebody's going to write a letter and say, that's crazy. That's preposterous. It would have to be 29,035 feet deep to cover Mount Everest, plus 22 feet on top of that. Okay, I hear you. But that assumes facts, not in evidence. It assumes that Mount Everest, at 29,035 feet, was in existence in the antediluvian world. And it wasn't. The Himalaya Mountains are still rising. They are getting taller. The Indian subcontinent is, in fact, smashing into Asia. That's a fact. We can measure it. We can see it, weigh it, taste it, touch it, smell it. That's science, kids. And more than one person can do that. We can take it into the laboratory. We're not here arguing with science. Science is knowledge. We're not here arguing with knowledge. What we're taking exception to here is speculation, assuming facts, not in evidence, theories and hypotheses, and we believe. We have faith. Evolutionary philosophy is a religion, just like Baptist theology is a religion. You're entitled to it. I'm not arguing with you about that. But you can't take that kind of faith into court. You can't use the rules of evidence. You can't arrive at an intelligent conclusion based upon faith, theories, hypotheses, and we believe that, and we assume. Number two, Kwok Ting test. Testimony must contain extemporaneous detail. Extemporaneous detail. It certainly does do that. It has details in there that when we apply the tests of cross-examination to it, will reveal whether or not this story has been contrived or not. Now, that story was told at least to Moses 3,000 years ago. Moses wrote that down. That's why we have it in writing today. Moses wrote that. Did Moses get that from some other writing that was in it? I don't think he did. I think that the statement that says all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction deals a death blow to the idea that Moses got that from some historical source that he picked up in Egypt. The Scripture says that that isn't so. So if we just gave the Scripture face value, ancient documents record, said, well, unless you can come in here and prove that he got that out of some written document from Egypt, we'd have to accept the scriptural testimony. And that's what the rules of evidence dictate. So we've got these first two tests. The testimony is complete, and the testimony contains extemporaneous detail. Lots of detail in here. Third thing, though, it requires that the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. Well, I would submit to you that the Badlands of eastern Washington is one powerful piece of evidence for a worldwide flood. And I would contend that the Grand Canyon is a powerful piece of evidence for a worldwide flood. Now, evolutionists like to point to the Grand Canyon, and they say, see, the Grand Canyon is proof positive that we evolved, and that Charles Lyell was correct, because every year we measure the erosion of the river in the bottom of the canyon, and we come to the conclusion that it is eroding at the rate of 1 inch every 100 years. Now, boys and girls, I have never been down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. I don't have a clue as to whether or not that river is eroding at the rate of 1 inch every 100 years or 100 feet every 100 years. I don't know. All I know is what the scientists and all these paid professionals are telling me. As old Will Rogers said, hell, all I know is what I read in the papers. So, I'm going to give their testimony 100% full value, okay? But the Grand Canyon did not develop from that river that we're looking at today, eroding that hole out at the rate of 1 inch per 100 years. That didn't happen. And anybody with a half a brain just looking at that thing and looking at the numbers there can see that. So let me give you a couple numbers here. Go up to Glen Canyon. There's a dam up there before it goes into the Grand Canyon. It's called the Glen Canyon Dam. Elevation 1,680 feet, as I recall. Something like that. Okay? You follow that? That's the Colorado River. No? And it's flowing, you know, from left to right. Or right to left, depending upon whether you're north or south, you know. So now go through the Grand Canyon down to the other end of it, and you come out to Hoover Dam, Boulder Dam, whatever you want to call it. Then it's about 800 feet above sea level. Okay, makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? Okay, it starts up here at 1600 feet, runs through the canyon, comes out at the other end at 800 feet. Now, this canyon is a mile deep. Have you ever heard that? If you go up there to the south rim, as I recall, the south rim is at 8,000 feet. Is that correct? I'm just talking off the top of my head here. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's 7,000-8,000 feet. It's pretty damn high up. Got that? All right. Now, if you got these numbers down here, boys and girls, we're just going to do our arithmetic here. And I'm just going to take the numbers that these guys give us, run them through our Texas Instruments, Sharp EL1197G3, and then let's just apply that like 12 jurors back in the jury room, okay? We've listened to the testimony. Now let's put two and two together and see what Dell tells us. The canyon over here at the south rim, 5,000 feet down to the bottom, where the water comes into the canyon is 1,680 feet, less than 2,000 feet. Does water run uphill? Come on, think about that. Does water run uphill? If your IQ is over 80, the answer is no. Does water run downhill? Again, if your IQ is 80 or better, the answer is yes, it does. Is 1,680 feet higher than 800 feet? Again, if your IQ runs around 80 or better, the answer is yes. The evolutionist comes up and says, see? See? What'd I tell you? The Grand Canyon was carved out by the Colorado River. Hell, I can see that. You can see that. All of us can see that. All except but for one thing. Water don't run uphill. Now, boys and girls, when you get up to the South Rim, there was a point in time when the South Rim and the North Rim were connected, and the distance between those two points, which is about 11 miles, as I recall. I flew across there a couple times. It's 11 miles across there. That is a big hole. Now, what I want you guys out there in evolutionary land to tell me is, how in the hell does the river at 1,700 feet at Glen Canyon wash out that big hole when the big hole is sitting up here at 8,000 feet? Huh? Come on now. Let's wake up and smell the coffee. So, uniformitarianism does not answer the question, where did all that dirt go, and how'd that river wash that out? Now, the Bible tells you and has an answer. See, it's called the universal flood, and it's in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. Now, if you had a great big volume of water, you could scour out a piece of real estate like that, but you ain't scouring out a piece of real estate like that with that little volume of water that's going through that river today. Here's another one. 5,280. That's how many feet there are from the south rim down to the river. It's more than that. It's more than a mile deep. Times 12 inches to a foot, times 100, equals 6,336,000 years. 6,336,000 years. Now, remember Carl Sagan? He used to say billions and billions of years ago. Okay, billions and billions. Was Carl Sagan here billions and billions of years ago? Were you here billions and billions of years ago? Excuse me. That's 6,336,000. I said 6 billion, but it's 6,336,000. Were you here 6 million years ago? See, what we're dealing with here again is assuming facts, not in evidence. We've got things that we can see today, and we'll take their number. We'll take their number. The river is washing out at the rate of 1 inch, down there at the bottom of the river, 1 inch, every 100 years. That's their number. But that thing's 11 miles wide. 11 miles wide. Now, if we took the biblical story, then that canyon was washed out within the period of 371 days. If we take the evolutionist, he tells us 6,336,000 years. The problem with the evolutionary story over here, when we apply the math to it, is that the river, when it comes into the canyon, is at 1,700 feet, and it's washing out dirt that's already piled up to 8,000 feet. The water that came over the canyon had to have already been up to 8,000 feet. Kids? Well, either that, or we had to have some kind of tectonic force that raised the thing up while the scouring was going on, don't we? The physical evidence that we're looking at does not fit with the story that we're being told with evolution. Furthermore, the physical evidence that we see does not fit with the local flood theory, but the physical evidence that we see does fit with the story that we see in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. Now, why don't you read Genesis 6, 7, and 8 with that in mind? Go get yourself a topographical map and take a look at these elevations to see whether I'm lying to you or not. But hell, any of you people that have ever been to the Grand Canyon walked up to the south rim, didn't you? I mean, you know, you can get to the north rim. That's a little trickier. But did you look down into the hole? Did anybody ever tell you? Did any of these evolutionists ever tell you, hey, when the river comes into the canyon, it's at 1,600 feet and exits at 8? Then did they tell you, well, how'd that water run uphill from 1,700 feet to 8,000 feet, scour that thing out down to 800 feet down at Boulder Dam? You know, the physical evidence there fits with a universal flood, doesn't fit with a local flood, doesn't fit with the river scouring out at the rate of an inch every 100 years. And that's just where reality is at. Let's take a look and see if we've got any witnesses to that. One of the most important biblical passages relating to the magnitude of the deluge is found in the New Testament, 2 Peter 3, verses 3 through 7. Now, you Christians can read that. See, Christians, they reject the Old Testament. Just like the Jews. The Jews reject the New Testament. Well, the Christians reject the Old Testament. See? Jesus said, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God, and that it's profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction. See? And Jesus said, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God does man live. Where do you get that idea? Well, he got that from Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. It's a direct citation. There's 435 of those direct quotations in the New Testament directly taken from the Old. Evidently, the New Testament writers did not understand that the Old Testament had been abolished and nailed to the cross with Jesus. Otherwise, how come they cited it 435 times? Huh? Now, there's a second factor that comes in here. Let's think about this. The day that Jesus made the statement, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, how much of the New Testament was written at that date? And the answer is zero. Zero. Not one word of the New Testament was put down on paper until after Jesus died. Jesus didn't write any of it, remember? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote the Gospels. Paul wrote 14 letters. John wrote Revelation. So when we get down to bottom line, not a word had been written. Jesus says, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Well, what word had proceeded out of the mouth of God up to that moment in time when he made that statement? Well, the only words that had been written so far were the 39 books of the Old Testament, weren't they? Now, Jesus thought every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, did that include Genesis 6, 7, and 8? Huh? You know, when we just apply a little bit of elemental logic and just follow directions, you know, all of a sudden, where does that leave us? Now, listen, we got to have more witnesses. At the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. All right, now, we have the testimony of God written by Moses in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. You know, at the mouth of two witnesses, this is in Deuteronomy 19:15, I believe it is, at the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. So we've got an affidavit there, and then we have a second testimony here. It says, knowing this first, that in the last days mockers shall come with mockery. That's you evolutionists out there. Identifies you people to a T. You mock, which is your right to do. I'm not arguing with you. But mockers shall come, mocking, walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? Hey, what about this Jesus guy? You know, this guy's, he's slower than the second coming of Christ. For from the day that the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. That's what we call today evolutionary philosophy. That's what we got from Charles Lyell. For this they willingly forget that there were the heavens of old, from of old, and on earth, and an earth, compacted out of the water and amidst the water, by the word of God, by which means the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens that now are, and the earth, by the same word, have been stored up for fire, being reserved against the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. Hey, here's a new prophecy here. He said, now I got you with water the first time. Now the next time I get you, I'm going to burn you. And then, of course, the religious guys, they come along here and they got Dante Alighieri's hellfire. They've got the world being burned up. I mean, there's all kinds of ideas out there. And some of them have some merit and some of them have little or no merit. I'm not going to get into that, but I just wanted to point out to you, we got a second witness. This is called the New Testament. Testament. And the Old Testament. That's two witnesses here, kids. Two testaments. Told you that this flood was here and that the flood was universal. Okay. Now, we got an ancient document. We can meet the Kwok Ting test with the testimony must be complete, the testimony must contain extemporaneous detail, and the testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. We got the evidence and we got the witnesses. You know, I can make a case and take it into federal court under those rules. Yeah, I'm about to run out of time here again. I'm going to have to close off here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and they can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.